Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, did the sexual counter-revolution polarize American politics? And then, on the Scholar Circle, how might the power of ideas shape countries and international power structures? Have conflicts about sex, women's rights, women's roles, and gay civil rights polarized Americans into irreconcilable warring camps? Our next guest says they have. Nancy Cohen charts the birth of the sexual counter-revolution and its climb to power with her new book, Delirium. Nancy Cohen is a historian and visiting scholar at UCLA. She's authored several books, including The Reconstruction of American Liberalism from 1865 to 1914, and the one we're discussing now, Delirium. Welcome, Nancy Cohen.
Hello, Maria. Thanks for having me here.
One of the things I found striking about your book is the changes that occurred specifically in the Republican Party. A couple of the leaders of the past you noted, Barry Goldwater, supported women's right to abortion and some version of gay rights. Give us the historic sense of Republican leadership in terms of these specific personal and sexual issues.
Today's Republican Party is not your mother's Republican Party. The Republican Party used to actually be the party of small government and personal liberty. And it was far superior to the Democratic Party on women's rights. Some Republicans like Barry Goldwater, when gay rights started to come up in the 90s, was as good as you can be on it. He was co-chair of the Committee for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. What happened is that in the 70s, in reaction to the sexual revolution, feminism, and gay rights, a group of reactionaries, surprisingly mostly women, organized to turn back the clock. And they went up against the Equal Rights Amendment and they defeated it. They actually fought against federally funded childcare and they defeated that too. They were the ones that ran the first referendum campaign to take rights away from gays, and they won that. And then in the late 70s, what they did is they infiltrated the Republican Party at the precinct level, at the local level, at the school board level, and ultimately took it over from bottom to top. And what we're seeing today is kind of the logical result of 40 years of sexual counter-revolution that was started by ordinary right-wing fundamentalist women.
So let's talk about who these women are. You named them in the book, so let's name them here. Phyllis Schlafly was one of them. Talk about the leaders and who they were and what their motivation was.
So Phyllis Schlafly is the one that many people remember. She had a background in the John Birch Society and the right wing and the Goldwater campaign. But she was pretty much a nothing in the early 70s. She had a couple thousand followers among these right-wing, John Birch Republican women. But what happened when she started writing about the Equal Rights Amendment, the word got out to the South to fundamentalist women who basically freaked out about the idea of women's equality, of women being in the workforce, of women not being home taking care of their children. That's when this movement got legs. And one of the key leaders who's really unknown was this woman named Lottie Beth Hobbs, who was a middle-aged woman who made her living teaching church and writing books for Christian ladies. And she was a member of a church that actually forbid women to teach men. She wrote really the kind of Magna Carta of the anti-feminist movement, what was called the Pink Sheet, where she said God created women with certain privileges and those crazy feminists want to take your privileges away.
So you've given us the sort of synopsis of it, and we know that that evolved into some other documents and campaigns, and then there seemed to have been a coalition that was built.
It was really these church women, particularly women in the Churches of Christ and also Mormon women, who organized in their churches to get a kind of mass movement for this. Schlafly played a role by being their leader, teaching them communications, teaching them how to lobby, teaching them what color to wear on TV. In the late 70s, what happened is a kind of intellectuals of the new right got wind of these movements in the States. And they saw that they could make a profitable alliance because they actually had no voters who supported, ending Social Security and all these laws of ALEC, for example. The founder of that, Paul Weyrich, was the person who first saw these fundamentalist women and first made an alliance. So they formed this pro-family coalition. Reagan's campaign got wind of it and realized that their Southern strategy would have to include not just race, but also religion. And that's how the religious right came on to Reagan's campaign. What happened in the early years, really the new right leaders, the moneyed leaders, were really in control, and they threw a few bones to these sexual fundamentalists, but they really didn't meet many of the promises that they had made to them. Everything shifted in the 90s. The tables turned. These people that had been kind of used by the new right actually took control of the right and took control of the Republican Party.
So if we were going to back up and look at the various key points in history, one of the ones that you think is most important is the birth control pill. Why?
So what the pill did is it gave women control over their sexuality for the first time in human history, really. And in doing that, it also gave women control over their economic life, because women could now have sex, have children when they wanted to, stop having children when they were ready, and prepare for a career. One of the most fascinating pieces of research I came across was by two economists who showed that there is actually a causal connection between the pill being available to college-age women and women pursuing college and graduate careers. So really, it's very difficult to imagine how women would have even close to the economic parity we have today if it weren't for women being able to control their sexuality, leaving aside all the, you know, issues of principle and philosophy and American freedom that
just
women should.
Just the pragmatic issues, right.
Yes.
This then had a bit of a backlash as well.
Yes. The sexual revolution gave a particular color to the women's rights movement of the 60s, because it was the first time in the history of women's movements that you really have the ability for sexual freedom coming together with all the other issues that matter for women's rights. All of this together really outraged religious fundamentalists, both Protestant fundamentalists and also religions that take their dictates from an authority and teach that women should be submissive to men. So particularly Orthodox Catholicism and Mormonism. So those were the three groups that were involved in this sexual counter-revolution from the early days, still the case. It really was about this idea they had, and I don't know how to say it in any other way, that sex was destroying America.
One of the parts I enjoyed most about the book was the section where you talked about the history of birth control and the laws around it. When did birth control become a constitutional right, and how?
It became a constitutional right for married couples in 1965, and it was extended to all people, single people as well. I believe the case was 1974. Laws against birth control started being passed in the late 19th century, in the Victorian era. Actually, the Connecticut law that was overturned in 1965 by Griswold versus Connecticut was written by P.T. Barnum. So that's just one of those weird historical facts.
And well, he did like circuses.
The laws that made their way to the Supreme Court, it's important to realize that these came out of Connecticut and Massachusetts, not out of Mississippi and Alabama, that Massachusetts still had a law on its book titled Crimes Against Chastity in 1968. When I was writing this book, I myself was surprised at how recent these changes were. And I realized that a lot of women that I would be writing the book for and a lot of the young men I would be writing the book for probably didn't know this history. And so I felt it was important to see how actually revolutionary the sexual revolution was for us to understand why we've gone into this delirium in our politics over sex and birth control and transvaginal probes and gays.
The other part I thought was really fascinating was the difference between before civil rights for the genders as well as for the races and after, and how the law has changed with regards to sexual violence, the impact that the civil rights era has had. Could you trace that for us?
Before the civil rights law of 1964, and then a lot of the laws of the 70s, it was perfectly legal to discriminate against women in employment, and the want ads were actually sex segregated. It was perfectly legal for a husband to rape his wife. Those laws just changed in the 70s.
I hear some candidates would like to bring that back.
Yes. What was it? In Utah, the claim the doctor should ask a woman whether she was really raped or whether it was her husband's baby. Unbelievable. So the law treated women as second-class citizens without full legal protections. Women were not allowed to serve on juries in certain states. Even if a woman was being tried, she wasn't being tried by a jury of her peers because women were excluded.
All men.
Yes. The changes occurred when women's rights activists actually very smartly inserted women's rights into the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and kind of tricked people who thought it would be a poison pill for the whole Civil Rights Act into adopting it. And then through a lot of legal cases, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was one of the pioneering lawyers in overturning a lot of these discriminatory laws. And then a lot of movement building, for example, to win legal abortion. And so by the end of the 70s, everything had really changed.
The other nice to hear it again phrase was the personal is political. And I say that partly because it extends beyond just feminism, that the personal is political, and people don't realize how true that is. But it was good to have you revisit it and how it actually applies.
This is a phrase that arose in the feminist movement of the 70s, but it really applies to everyone, and it applies particularly to gays, because one thing I forgot to mention as we were just talking about this is that every state in the nation had laws against sodomy on its books in the 1960s. By the end of the 1970s, about half the states had eliminated those laws. And interestingly, the federal government had eliminated discrimination against gays in every area except in the military. That's how we ended up with this battle over don't ask, don't tell. Right. But it was actually quite recently that the government stopped discriminating in every other federal agency. What's more important than your ability to have control over your own body, to not have the police break into your house and arrest you because you're having sex with someone of the same sex? I mean, that happened in the early 2000s. Mainstream America really does care most about the economy, but they don't want to go backward on what we consider no-brainers about women's rights and women's equality and fairness toward gays and lesbians.
You wrote about important players on both sides of the aisle, labor unions, for example, and how they played a role in this entire process of the sexual politics.
Yeah, so let's talk about labor unions. So the sexual counter-revolution was a bipartisan affair. It occurred within the Democratic Party as well, and it's played a large role in the Democrats' continuing divisions, their paralysis when they're in power, and their overreaction when they're out of power. What happened in 1972 in the first open primary ever in the Democratic Party, also the first time that 18-year-olds could vote, is that women and young people, small number of gays and kind of black activists organized to win seats at the Democratic Convention, and they supported McGovern. The old power brokers and kingpins in the party were outraged, one, that they didn't win these delegate seats, and that, as they put it, their party had been taken over, had been hijacked. So George Meany, the most powerful man in the U.S. who wasn't an elected official and who was the head of the AFL-CIO, said of the new Democrats, "The Democratic Party has been taken over by abortionists, boys who want to marry boys, girls who want to marry girls," and he refused to support George McGovern. It's the only time since the New Deal that Labor hasn't supported the Democratic presidential candidate. And there were some other old reactionaries in the party on these sex and gender issues. Now, remind you, Meany was one of the most liberal men in the country. He played a large role in passing civil rights. He played a large role in passing Medicare. I do have sympathy for the reaction of the time, and we particularly saw it among older ethnic whites. That part passed fairly quickly in the Democratic Party, in part because most of the people who shared that views were Southern fundamentalists who had already moved into the Republican Party on racial issues. And the other ones, like Meany, died, you know, by the time we got to the 80s. But the legacy they left is this idea that Democrats lose by being socially progressive, that standing strong on feminism and gay rights is a losing proposition with so-called mainstream America. Now, if they were right, then you'd have to acknowledge that. The fact is that all the facts show that that's absolutely wrong, and the reverse is the case. The Democrats win elections because they are socially progressive. They've picked up millions of former Republicans on the issues, particularly of women's rights.
Has that been the case over the last few decades, or is that only current?
That very clear shift as of 1992, and it was already starting to show in the 70s with the college educated.
I ask that because exit polls, when the elections came down and the Republican Revolution occurred, and even after that, when the exit polls were done, people said straight out, I voted on family values. And that was code for I was voting against gay marriage.
So a couple things. One is the 2004 election, that so-called values voters. Within days, that exit poll was determined by all credible pollsters to have been deeply flawed, because the only question for a Republican to answer was values voter. And the pollsters and the political scientists have absolutely determined and absolutely agree that George Bush won on security and terrorism. There was no shift in the vote on so-called values. The exit polls, these are raw numbers that haven't been put through statistical analysis, haven't been put through regressions. Basically, when you analyze these numbers, there's lots of polling and you can tell why people voted. And many political scientists have shown that this idea that the white working class has left over cultural issues is not true.
You had a whole chapter that dealt with Carter and Reagan. Carter was particularly interesting. Everybody knew he was a religious man. Everybody knew more or less his positions. You tie that in with then the Reagan Revolution.
Jimmy Carter was a transitional figure in a lot of ways. One was on the issue of the White South and religion. So it wasn't yet clear in the mid-70s that the White South was lost for the Democratic Party. And it absolutely left over race initially, but then conservative religion bolstered it. About half of the fundamentalists in the country are very conservative. About a quarter are progressive and a quarter don't vote. And Jimmy Carter fell on most issues in that progressive quarter. But he in some ways got blindsided by these issues of women's rights and gay rights and abortion. He wasn't prepared for it. And so he thought that he could have his Southern fundamentalists and his feminists in the same coalition. And so it was during his presidency that those issues came to a head, in part because the right wingers forced them to a head. So that's where he's a transitional figure on the South. He was also a transitional figure in turning the Democratic Party in a more conservative direction, but in a not successful way. He alienated the Northern liberals in the party in many ways over lots of other issues, you know, healthcare. And so Ted Kennedy launched a very damaging primary campaign against Carter, from which he never recovered. But the economy was terrible, and the hostages were still held in Iran. Everybody pretty much agrees that it was a throw-the-bum-out election, not some conservative revolution. Reagan only won with a little bit more than 50% of the vote, but he won by bringing the religious right into his administration. And although he didn't give them much power, he did give them power over family policy and women's issues. With Reagan, we get the first moves toward restrictions on abortion, restrictions on international funding over abortion, and that kind of thing.
One other person I'm going to ask you about, and then let's talk more about the overall big picture and what we're seeing today. And that is, you had just a little paragraph, maybe a page, on David Brock.
Yes. Really interesting figure. He played a huge role in the Clinton scandals by publishing the Troopergate article, which was just a pack of lies that everybody agreed. But he really kind of lit up the right wing and the fundamentalists with those allegations against Clinton and also against Hillary as well. He realized that he was not being a reputable journalist when he started going back to do research about his first book about Anita Hill and realizing that he had been played by Clarence Thomas's people. And he had been contracted to write a hit piece on Hillary timed for the 1996 election, and he realized he couldn't do it again. The other thing, Brock was gay, and he was outed. He became very famous in the midst of all this, and I forget the circumstances under which he was outed, but once he was, he discovered what the people he had been associating with were really like. They were really awful to him. He was a leading writer of the right through the first term of the Clinton administration, and now he is the head of Media Matters.
Right. Your general theme, I think I took a quote right out of your book, the sexual counter-revolution helped to destroy both political parties, polarized America. You said it has distorted politics, distracted us from priorities, broken government institutions, and denied opportunity and liberty to many Americans. That's a lot.
It is, and it's all true. I don't think this is the only cause of our political dysfunction today, but I do want to emphasize that it is one of the central ones. And until we recognize it, we are actually not going to be able to fix our broken politics. And we will keep being convinced that, oh, these women's issues, these gay issues, oh, they're just a sideline. We really shouldn't talk about them much. We should focus on what's really important. And the right wing takes power again because that is, in fact, what they care about. They do want to go back to pre-sexual revolution. They want women back in the home. They want to stop unmarried people from having sex. They want to put gays back into second-class citizenship. Now, that's unacceptable to the 80% of America who doesn't agree with them. These people constitute only 15 to 20% of the electorate, surprisingly, but they have a lot of power because of their political savvy. No one thinks that one of the world's powers should be debating whether birth control is legal in 2012.
It has affected policies that are really important. And one of the key examples you gave was when there was a debate going on about funding the troops while they were in Afghanistan and Iraq. And many would say we should have just pulled them out anyway. Most of our listeners would agree with that. But instead of taking up that debate, they held up the vote in order to destroy Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the repeal of it.
They actually attached a rider to this funding bill that they would not pass the funding unless Don't Ask, Don't Tell was taken out of it. And that's how we ended up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal as a separate standalone item. But still, the Republicans claim the Tea Party was about the jobs, and they spent the year introducing 1,100 pieces of legislation around the country to restrict abortion. They practically shut down the government over funding for Planned Parenthood less than 100 days after they took office. They're so single-minded about taking away women's rights and carrying on about sexual issues that they're really letting fundamental issues that this country needs to face languish.
Did you get a sense in your research about how much that was occurring, how many major pieces of legislation got distracted?
I saw a few big pieces of legislation that this affected. So, for example, the United States would have had a very well-funded universal child care in the 70s if these women hadn't organized against federally funded childcare. And this is a case where the Democrats got so scared that they never brought this back up again in a really pure form. That's how we got all these ridiculous child tax credits that really don't help working people, because these Republican women killed this so early and Democrats became so afraid to bring it up. Another case is DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act. About five or six of these Christian right sexual fundamentalist organizations introduced it in the Iowa caucus in 1996 and forced all of the Republican candidates to take a position on it, which then brought it to Congress. And then it was the year that Clinton was running really scared, and he signed DOMA in the middle of the night. George Bush's first veto was on stem cell research. He hadn't bothered to veto anything for, I think it was 5 years, until the stem cell research bill came up.
You think it's only a small percentage of people that actually support this? Why is it playing such a massive role?
Because the small minority who supports it are all Republicans. They're all Republican activists. And they make up anywhere from 40 to 60% of Republican voters, depending on what state you're in. It's probably about 45% nationwide. The Republican obsession with birth control and gays and abortion and transvaginal probes and sluts is actually a logical result of the fact of who has the power in the Republican Party. And the people who have the power are the sexual fundamentalists. They're close to half of the vote in the Republican primary, and they're very good.
And they're the active ones.
They're the ones who have run all the moderates out of the party. So the Republican Party doesn't necessarily agree with it, but they're held hostage. Now, I do think that Romney is far more conservative on these women's issues and sexuality issues than he wants people to think. Now that it looks like the primary is wrapping up, Romney's people are going to be trying their best to shut everybody down from talking about this. People forget what happened this month. The election's a long time away.
You mentioned very early on that the women who began this counter-revolution did belong to a couple of specific churches. One was the Mormon Church. If you look at the Mormon Church today, given Mitt Romney's affiliation with the Mormon Church, do you think that it has changed at all in its positions, or is it still the same as it was back when the pink sheet was written?
I think it's more or less the same. The Mormon Church was the only official church in the United States to take a stand against the Equal Rights Amendment. They actually excommunicated women who supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Romney's not just affiliated with the Mormon Church. He was one of the highest religious officials in the Boston area. He counseled women not to have abortions, even for health reasons. He counseled single women to give up their children. That's in the new biography of Romney. And he has promised the National Organization of Marriage that he will do everything possible to ban gay marriage. He has told Mike Huckabee that he essentially supports the personhood amendments, which would give fertilized eggs full legal rights and take those rights essentially away from the women holding those eggs.
Does that count for embryos that people created through doctors that are sitting in a refrigerator?
Yes. They think it would bar a lot of the fertility treatments. People would not be allowed to do these fertility treatments, and that they would ban the birth control pill and the IUD. So Romney actually could open the door to birth control being banned. It's not far-fetched.
So I'm thinking about when he was governor, and he didn't exude a lot of this perspective.
No, that's not true. He ran as a moderate, but in office, he supported a constitutional ban against gay marriage to overturn Massachusetts gay marriage. He vetoed legislation to provide the morning after pill to rape victims. He turned on a dime as soon as he got into office on these social issues. So I think that the only time that he was lying was when he ran in Massachusetts.
Given your analysis that this counter-revolutionary fundamentalist group has pushed out the moderates of the Republican Party and moved it so far to the right, and given the up-and-coming young people who are generally not so fundamentalist in their beliefs, either about sexuality and certainly not on the gay issues, not to the extreme that we're seeing, do you predict that the Republican Party will either fall apart down the road with young people, or do you predict that it will have to morph back into something that accounts for the younger generation's beliefs?
It's hard to know how many years they have left on this track. This is, I do think, the last gasp of the people that support this are over 65, demographically unrepresentative. Ultimately, because America's constitutional system favors two parties and makes it very difficult to have any less or any more than two parties, the Republican Party will have to change and will have to make itself acceptable to the mainstream of America.
Thank you so much, Nancy Cohen. The book is called Delirium, How the Sexual Counterrevolution is Polarizing America.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, the power of ideas to shape countries, foreign policies, and the world. Stay tuned.
Well, she's fashionably lean, and she's fashionably late. She'll never rank a scene. She'll never break a day. But she's no drag, just watch the way she walks. She's a 20th century fox. She's a 20th century fox.
Hello and welcome back. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. How do ideas shape political realities? How do they interact with other more concrete factors to drive political agendas and then shape countries and international relations? How might the reinterpretation or misinterpretation of these ideas and concepts change the course of history? We're joined by three experts. Elizabeth Borgwart is a professor at Washington University and the University of Chicago. She is author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch is professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne. He is author of a number of publications, including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy. Christopher McKnight-Nichols is a fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and professor of history at Oregon State University. He is author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. The main purpose of this is to look at this evolution of U.S. foreign policy and how we got to where we are today. And each of you have looked at this different eras and also from different approaches. And I thought one of the places to start would be with Liz Borgwart. You led one of your articles with how ideas themselves affect the future.
And it's not so much ideas on their own, but ideas as energizing institutions, as energizing individuals or social movements, the way ideas connect and interact with other factors. I think the classic image is the sociologist Max Weber saying that ideas are never going to be the coal that fires the engine of that train of history, but they can be the tracks that the train goes on. And obviously, where the tracks are really affects what the destination is, that you, where you wind up.
I'm going to ask you to give some examples in a minute, but I think maybe where we should start in looking at that is Chris McKnight-Nichols. You have looked at these concepts, ideas, and their interpretations of, say, isolationism, internationalism, and how much people's ideas about the ideas have affected what the United States has become as a world player and how that has, of course, affected the rest of the world, starting with maybe even the founders.
I agree with Liz Borgwart that ideas really matter, and ideas may matter in some ways more in foreign policy. So I would start with sort of two maybe fundamental precepts of that. That on the one hand, ideas matter to the masses. This is true from 1776 as it is to now. That is, sort of mass ideologies legitimize the roles that policymakers can take on. And then ideas clearly matter to the policymakers themselves. They frame the tracks. They frame the system of how individuals and groups, the train of state, to continue that metaphor, where it can go. So just to lay out a few of the more specific yet abstract ideas that have informed sort of revolutionary policymakers and others, there's always been a kind of ideological fervor and what you might call a messianic streak in American foreign policy. And you might also note then, too, that there's been something that we are really recently, historians and individuals throughout the world are greatly interested in, and that is kind of thinking about what Jefferson called in the Declaration of Independence, decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Now, certainly, American foreign policy hasn't always, or perhaps even often, cared that much about the respect for the opinions of mankind, but that has also been a major part of American foreign policy making. And I would add as well, pragmatism, or sort of a more diminished form of pragmatism, that is a willingness to compromise and achieve vital goals, has been something that unites Washington, Adams, Jefferson, to far later followers in their footsteps, like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, and others.
It seems like in your book that it's also the reinterpretation of those original concepts that have shaped eras and directions. Like, what do they really mean? So the meanings about the concepts.
Absolutely. There may be sort of nothing more American than a sort of a sensibility of the nation's own exceptionality, which is often referenced through the early American Republic, the early history of the Republic. In terms of foreign policy, my work, I single out three what I call policy pillars. Those are Washington's farewell address in 1796, Jefferson's first inaugural address in 1801, and the Monroe Doctrine of 1823. And these are referenced for virtually every policymaker thereafter, regardless of the direction they want to take the country. They try to update the model of steering clear of foreign entanglements, to paraphrase, for each era.
It seems like we've gone quite a ways in the other direction from that. Tim Lynch, let's bring you in.
Well, I'd agree with much of that. I think it's worth restating that the United States is an idea. There is no United States until they have a revolution predicated on this idea. We know that other nations have had revolutions and have been animated by some very profound ideologies and very problematic ones, but the nation predates them. So if you looked at the English Revolution, the French, the Russian, the Chinese, these revolutions don't create the nation. America is created by its idea, by its ideology, and as a consequence, it's more prone, in this sense I think it is exceptional, it's more prone to ideological behavior and ideational discourse than most other nations, even though these other nations have had very well-defined periods of ideological behavior. You think of the Nazis, you think of fascism, communism, whereas the United States has this ideology, but in some strange way it's become powerful as a state because of its pragmatism as well as its ideology. It's understanding how these two things relate to each other and balance each other, complement each other, that is necessary for explaining the overall success of the American foreign policy over the long term.
And you say success of American foreign policy, which I'm assuming you mean by the U.S. becoming such a large global player world.
I think it's a very simple metric, and even those that have a downer on current expression of American power. It's gone from being a diddly squat trading outpost on the eastern seaboard of British North America to being not just an important global power, but the most powerful nation in world history. Now, I know geography has something to do with that, and climate, and the absence of neighbors, etc., etc. But it also has something to do with its foreign policy and how it's dealt with the world. All the other competitor states, Russia, China, Britain, France, Spain, they all had notions, universalist notions of their model, and they've become not irrelevant to world history, but they played a secondary role. And we can debate how far this is going to endure. But the American system prospered. It went from nothing to really being everything, whilst the competitors failed. And I think that's got something to do with its foreign policy.
Tim makes a fascinating series of points about American exceptionalism, which has been very much in the news of late. And, you know, it reminds me of the opposition between traditional ideas about American exceptionalism, that it had a lot to do with having a frontier, for instance, the famous Frederick Jackson Turner thesis from the previous century, and the idea that because of the frontier, Americans could sort of remake themselves at any given moment. And then you have more modern ideas about American exceptionalism, like the, I know I'm quoting so many sociologists today, but Seymour Martin Lipset saying, you know, there's a basket of values that can be considered quintessentially American, notably individualism, and that if you subscribe to these values, that makes you American, because it's an ideationally oriented idea, American exceptionalism. It's not just that, there are frontiers other places too, right? Brazil had a frontier. Russia had a frontier. So maybe these ideas about being separated by oceans and having frontiers are necessary but not sufficient. maybe even similarly with having a revolution. But some of the ideas that Tim is talking about synthesized to make, what's the difference that makes a difference, I think is an exciting question.
That would bring in the question of these ideologies and how they have shaped the direction of leadership. For example, Liz, you talked about FDR advancing the human rights movement without really meaning to.
Right. It's much in the way that Professor Chris Nichols just articulated. In my book, I also use as a jumping off point a particular document. It was called the Atlantic Charter of 1941. It's not nearly as well known as the documents that Chris just referenced. But basically, it was a statement of war and peace aims. And what's cool about that is that it was negotiated in August of 1941, which is, of course, before the United States is in the war, right? So it's before Pearl Harbor. So what is FDR doing, negotiating with Churchill a set of aims for the post-war, you know, what the world is going to look like after this war is over, that the United States isn't even in yet. And human rights were central to that vision in a way that went beyond just sort of generalizing the rights that we find, for instance, in the U.S. Bill of Rights.
Chris McKnight Nichols, let's bring you back in. And in addition to this trajectory, I'm also curious about the sort of ebb and flow that you noted in your book, particularly with the anti-imperialists and the isolationists who are pacifists, and how they have shaped or not shaped really where we are today.
So one thing that I often point out when I talk about my work on the subject is that humanitarianism is a relatively newcomer to the ideology, foreign policy kind of nexus. And it's the first moments of thinking about humanitarian intervention in the American context come with America's rise to world power in the late 19th century. And in particular, the sort of prism there is about the Spanish-American War and Spanish atrocities against Cubans. But of course, there's a notable blind spot as well that we see emerging right at that very first sort of genesis moment, and that is a blind spot towards American, not particularly humane activities, say in the Philippines and other words. For instance, the advent of waterboarding in American military affairs is actually in the context of the counterinsurgency against Filipino revolutionaries. But in terms of the ebb and flow here, you have from the late 19th century through the present, I hate to call it poles, but you see sort of hybrids of different visions. So on the one hand, you have those who oppose interventions abroad, generally speaking, and others who embrace them on a wide array of terms. So what I try to do in my book is to show the genesis of modern ideas about isolationism and show their actual relationship to new visions of internationalism. So, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s, you have fascinating alliances between so-called isolationists, like the Republican senator from Idaho, William Borah, a staunch isolationist, the so-called irreconcilable, with pacifist internationalists like the settlement house worker and reformer Jane Addams and Emily Balch, the first two women, actually, first two American women to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And they worked together for the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928 to outlaw war, for example. So what this shows us, I think, is that isolationism and internationalism were less of a binary and could often be combined in how Americans, policymakers and activists thought about their nation's role in the world.
Tim Lynch.
I'd agree with that. In some ways, these stereotypically oppositional concepts of isolationism and interventionism are both products of exceptionalism. You seek American isolationism because America is special and different and shouldn't be sullied by contact with the outside world. And by using the same rationale, you demand intervention to make the world in America's image. There's a common core. I mean, I think in some ways, and perhaps I don't want to overplay this, but there's a far greater complementarity in some of these quite differing understandings of what the nature of American power is, which has actually been very helpful in crafting what I've described as an effective foreign policy over the long term. Other nations tend to get sucked into very contrasting positions. I don't want to overuse the German analogy, but clearly in its history, it's had periods where it's looked outwards and periods where it's looked inwards, and these have had a markedly different impact on the quantum of German power. Whereas in the American case, America has got stronger in some ways because of the interplay of these two forces that seemingly pull it in the opposite direction. I'm partial to Walter Russell Mead's model. He outlines these four different foreign policy traditions, but his point is not that they are separate and distinct and cause dissensus and schizophrenia, that they work together over the long term. And that's why you're obliged to account for more success in the American story than you are its absence.
Given where we are today, and given this ideology and the idea and hope that the U.S. is actually a moral place, and the contradictions with things like what Chris mentioned in terms of the torture and the waterboarding and the massive amounts of deaths that have come as a result of some of the foreign policies, how do we reconcile the ideas and the rhetoric with the reality? Liz Borgwardt, I'm going to throw this to you.
Rhetoric can very often bootstrap reality. It's not a static snapshot of the relationship of rhetoric and reality. When I talk about that very aspirational document I just mentioned, the Atlantic Charter of 1941, you know, I'm sometimes asked when I speak about it, well, was it rhetoric or was it reality? And I feel like, well, what should I say? That it was, you know, 75% rhetoric and 25% reality. And like, that's the answer. No, I mean, when ideas are put out there, they inspire people, they change behavior, people get together, they form groups, they pressure decision makers. And it sort of circles back to, there's a sort of human impulse to reduce cognitive dissonance, I think, by sometimes slightly bringing the rhetoric and the reality into closer alignment. And one quick example that I would give would be, because we're historians, right, I'm going to give a historical example, but from the mid-70s, when the United States was negotiating with the then-Soviet Union in Helsinki, Finland, and you had this Helsinki Accord that was supposedly toothless and had all these human rights provisions. That's why the Soviets agreed to it, because there were no enforcement provisions. But it sparked, in many ways, a human rights revolution, because people started to believe that, you know, these Helsinki watch groups sprung up all over the world, all over Eastern Europe, and particularly Eastern Europe, people started writing, you know, poems about human rights and having human rights plays in their basement. And the rhetoric, in effect, changed the reality because it reshaped people's perceptions and expectations and even their culture.
Did we also see that here within the U.S., Chris McKnight-Nichols?
Absolutely. I'm struck both by the fact that rhetoric does play out in altering the terms of politics, domestic as well as foreign policy. So one connection here that we haven't yet made is between domestic and foreign policy. That is, used to be said that partisan politics stopped at water's edge. This was a classic phrase that policymakers noted. And yet, in fact, as we all know as citizens and as human beings, we tend to frame political rhetoric and political decision-making in terms of both domestic and foreign. That is, one of the ways in which we think many individuals debated the Iraq War and the yearly costs of the Iraq War was to think in terms of limited resources and the fact that roughly the yearly burn rate for the first 4 years or so was something in the order of $30 to $35 billion a year. That happens to be about the same amount as universal health care. Now, we know this is a false quid pro quo, but thinking about the rhetoric of foreign policy, of these commitments abroad, often has a domestic reference. So, for example, thinking back in the past, the racial reformer W.E.B. Du Bois argued that, quote, civilization begins at home, that the kind of rhetoric of civilizing other peoples and other nations, the sort of manifest destiny justifications that American policymakers were putting forward, in fact, had a clear corollary at home, and that is you can't go abroad to enact civilization and fulfill American democratic ideals until you fulfill them at home.
It's interesting you'd say that. I've heard many political scientists on our campus actually make that remark about exporting democracy. Well, why don't we fix ours first? And that sounds like the place to bring in Tim Lynch.
I think it's a good question, but if you make your foreign interventionism contingent on your domestic perfection, then you won't do anything. America would be a big insular power. We know it acts highly imperfectly, but on balance over the long term, what we've tended to prosper by, and by prosper I mean the delivery of freedom to people around the world, has been the product in the last 100 years of the application of American hard military power. Europe wouldn't exist in the form it does. Japan wouldn't exist in the form it does had America not waged war on them and in them. So I think in some ways this notion that you can replace this basic currency, hard American military power, with something nicer, a softer version, is problematic and not borne out by the historical record. So I think it's all very well to build a vocabulary of human rights and to trace this lineage, which I think is long and a very worthwhile thing to do. But we forget that the notion of human rights is contingent on their enforcement through power, through hard military power. And in the 20th century, that job has fallen to the United States.
I think many people would argue that there may have been excessive force in most of these cases in which there was so much loss of human life and other very important aspects of humanity that it's hard to justify the other side.
Well, I think it's an argument worth having.
So, Elizabeth Borgwardt, let's bring you back in on this.
Again, historians never like to talk very much about the future, but I think that this idea of, I'm so happy that Professor Lynch was talking about power, because I think a lot of particularly human rights specialists sort of shy away from these kinds of terms, and even in international relations, it's how do you talk about the interaction of, say, power and culture. I was talking about the Helsinki effect, so-called, earlier from that 1975 moment of having an ideology, inspire a social movement that then led to changed expectations and reconfigured politics. But we could even look now at, for instance, the Arab Spring. Who knows what the future of Arab Spring is? But it strikes me as patronizing to say, human rights are a Western construct. They're not for you because they're not indigenous. So, why don't you come up with some other way of framing your aspirations? Young people in the different Arab Spring movements have taken these ideas that maybe were publicly articulated in a more Western idiom initially, but they've really made them their own, and we'll see what happens.
In terms of the concepts we're talking about, bring in the concept that Joseph Nye uses, soft power, persuasive power, power of ideas. How does that fit in with American history, Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me both Tim's and Liz's points here intersect with another interesting aspect of American ideology in terms of foreign policy, and that is the ways, the sort of unintended consequences that American policymakers' rhetoric can entail. So a great example, Liz's work, for example, on the Atlantic Charter, and which she calls sort of a New Deal for the World, emerging even before America begins to fight the Second World War, or thinking about some of the paradoxical ways that isolationism emerges as something that cuts short annexations abroad, or American interventionism in my work. Or another example that comes to mind is Erez Manella's book, The Wilsonian Moment, which details how in Egypt, India, China, Korea, and beyond, sort of Woodrow Wilson's ideas about the 14 points, his call for a free, open-minded, absolutely impartial adjustment of colonial claims, often configured as self-determination, really resonated with nationalists around the world in ways that Wilson himself didn't foresee and didn't particularly like. And so some of the ways in which American foreign policy ideology plays out can be problematic, but actually can also be deeply empowering on a world stage.
Sometimes leaders say things and mean something completely different. And I think, Liz Borgwardt, that was one of the things that you wrote about, that it is interpreted in one way, whereas the leader means something completely different. Perhaps look at what the underlying intentions sometimes are. It sometimes is this rhetoric of human rights really an excuse for building power or building economic superiority or something to that effect? What do you think?
Well, I'm often asked variations of the question, aren't human rights just a mask for imperialism? And, it reminds me, it's a sort of international version of when I'm asked about, I often teach about the New Deal, and so the question will be, wasn't the New Deal just a mask for stabilizing capitalism? And with both of those questions, for me, the key word is the word just, because it was that, but it was some other things too. And so too with human rights, where there are moments of great fluidity in international politics where you can have things can be tugged in a somewhat more progressive direction. And you mentioned leaders meaning something different. I mean, that classic example in my book is the arch-imperialist Churchill, you know, articulating some of the most highfalutin phrases in the Atlantic Charter about all the men in all the lands living out their lives in freedom from fear and want. That's actually, he was paying a compliment to FDR by sort of quoting Roosevelt back to himself. But he was then asked in the British House of Commons if that applied to British colonial possessions in India and Africa. And he stood up and said, you know, I didn't become the king's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. I meant it for an inspirational value to help bring the United States in to support us.
Tim Lynch?
Well, I think this is a very interesting discussion. My concern in the discussion we're having is that if we disconnect concepts like human rights and exceptionalism from the capacity to enforce them and realize them, I think we have a problem. One of the great ironies in American history is that as America has got more powerful, and this bucks the trend, a thickening of international law. International law is the tool of the powerless. It's what you insist on when you haven't got the capacity to realize your ends through other means. Whereas the United States, and this is part of its exceptional character, has been at the forefront of international human rights regimes, of international law, as a way of building in its rule of law concept at home at a global level. I think that still requires understanding and recognition.
Chris McKnight-Nichols?
It strikes me that ideological positions have remained relatively fluid in American foreign policy, but there are some strong examples of those from Jefferson and Madison responding to British trade restrictions in the early 19th century, or Wilson in the League of Nations. When American policymakers have refused to compromise, they've met defeat. But you've also had examples, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's kind of realism, sometimes described as amoral realism, also couldn't really survive indefinitely without firmer foundations in maybe the nation's more, what we might call, more well-revered past principles. So it seems to me that we're struck with a kind of deep paradox about ideology in American foreign policy, that perhaps the most widespread belief, something that we've all been talking about today, is that American foreign affairs is a peculiar aspect of American history and that it has a sort of exceptionalist model. This is something that foreign policymakers have almost always wanted to attend to. And yet, the American public, at least historically, hasn't made many demands on policymakers to get deeper inside their ideologies, to understand more fully what ideologies guide our foreign policies. And so I wonder, as an open question in the 21st century, whether or not the American people, in terms of democratic accountability, will ask more about the ideologies of their presidents in terms of foreign policy.
That's a perfect place to leave it. Thank you to the three of you, Elizabeth Borgwart, professor of history at Washington University and University of Chicago, and author of A New Deal for the World, America's Vision for Human Rights, and the forthcoming The Nuremberg Idea, Crimes Against Humanity in History, Law, and Politics. Tim Lynch, professor in the School of Social Sciences and Political Sciences at University of Melbourne, author of publications including Turf War, the Clinton Administration in Northern Ireland, and also the forthcoming Cambridge Essential History of Post-Cold War U.S. Foreign Policy, and Christopher McKnight-Nichols, who's been with us once before, who is at the University of Pennsylvania and a professor of history at Oregon State University, author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of the Golden Age. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Great.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at @armudian.